It's Monday, April 15th. If the worst-case scenario was Iran and Israel in open warfare, well, this is about as close as you can get. We start here. For the first time, Iran launches an aerial attack on Israeli soil.
This used to be a shadow war, and now it came out into the open.
Our reporter was in Jerusalem as explosions went off overhead. Iran says they're ready to call it a day. Well, don't expect Israel to do the same.
Israelis see this as a terrific opening to once and for all punch Iran in the nose.
Now, the U.S. is desperately trying to keep this from spiraling out of control. And for the first time in history, a former U.S. president faces a criminal jury.
These are 34 criminal counts about falsifying business records.
We'll set you up for what's about to be an unprecedented trial in New York. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. For years now, even before this war in Gaza began, Israel and Iran have been engaged in a type of shadow war. Maybe Israel hits Iran's cyber infrastructure, and then Iran enlists one of its proxy groups to fire rockets into Israeli territory. Or more lately, Iran might detain an Israeli-owned ship, while Israel responds with an attack on Iranian assets somewhere else. The key to all this is it's never the official national military going into the other country's territory. That would be open warfare, right? This is a shadow war. Well, a couple weeks ago, an airstrike from Israel hit Iranian military officials. The key here was they weren't on Iranian soil. They were in Syria, but they were at a consular building, which are usually considered pretty off-limits by diplomats, at least. Iran was furious and said it would retaliate. Well, on Saturday night, they launched a massive airstrike aimed squarely at Israel itself.
It was quite scary when in the middle of the night we started hearing booming.
I really hope it won't be a big war now. None of us in Israel want a big war.
The war in Gaza has been devastating. It's been brutal, but it has been relatively contained. The question this morning is whether that has all just changed. ABC's foreign correspondent Jordana Miller is based in Jerusalem, where some of these strikes were seen in the air. Jordana, can you just walk us through what happened?
Well, you know, Israelis had been told for days that Iran was likely to launch a direct strike from its territory onto Israel. But then everything really went into high gear on Saturday night here. The Israeli spokesperson gave a televised address and said, Iran has launched hundreds of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles and drones, and they're headed our way. He tried to calm the country by saying, you know, we have all our systems in place, our air defense systems. We've dealt with these threats before. Our allies are helping us. And, you know, then we received another update that at about between 1 and 2 a.m., some of the missiles were not shot down, and some of them might be shot down over Israeli territory. The sirens started to go off first in Israel's north, meaning that some had come from the Lebanese and the Syrian border. Then the sirens went off in the south, then the West Bank, and then, to many people's surprise, sirens went off here in Jerusalem. And I would say it was just before 2 a.m. when that happened. I have two young kids. We went to crouch in our safe room, and all of a sudden we started to hear these loud explosions. Now, Israel has a multi-layered air defense system. One is the Iron Dome. The middle system is called the Arrow system, using the Patriot missiles. And then they have David's Sling, which is the most advanced. We heard probably 10 of these missiles or drones being intercepted right in Jerusalem's Old City, which is about a 15-minute walk from where I live. It was a historic night here, of course, because Iran has never struck Israel before. As you said, this used to be a shadow war, and now it came out into the open.
Did any of these missiles end up touching down? What was sort of the success rate of Israel's defenses here?
So between Israel, the United States, and other allies, the Israeli army says that Israel and its partners shot down with a 99% success rate almost all of the 350 missiles and drones that were shot over. That includes over 100 ballistic missiles.
Wow.
So there were a few ballistic missiles that made it through. One hit the Netavim airbase down in the south. That appears to be one of the main targets. That's where Israel keeps its F-35s. So it looks like the Iranians were trying to take out that airbase and destroy some of the F-35s. They didn't get anywhere close to doing that. So it was in terms of Israel and its partners, it was a spectacular success.
Well, yeah, and we've heard about now U.S. forces scrambling to blow a lot of these ordnance out of the sky. I think it was 70 projectiles shot down by U.S. forces alone. A Navy destroyer brought down 3 ballistic missiles. How are the United States and Israel and the Iranians, how are they talking about this now?
So Iranian leaders are saying, we're finished. We avenged the killing of our top general and commanders. And if Israel attacks again, the Iranians are saying, we will hit them even harder. And they're adding that if the United States takes part in any of Israel's counterstrike, then U.S. bases will also become targets. Of course, there are far-right leaders in Netanyahu's government, hawks, who are pushing for a major attack. But there's also an element in the war cabinet here hinting that Israel doesn't need to attack immediately.
We are devoted to the defense of Israel. We will support Israel. We will help defend Israel, and Iran will not succeed.
But one of the most important factors here is what President Biden thinks and wants. And he's been very clear that he does not want an escalation. He doesn't want a war. He's stood by Israel. And what he wants will be a major factor.
All right. Jordana Miller, there in Jerusalem. So glad you're safe and your family's safe. Thank you so much for checking in.
Thanks, Brad.
Now, I'm sure a lot of you, me included, are wondering, what happens next then? What are the next steps here? Let's go to Colonel Stephen Ganyard. He's a former Marine and State Department official, now an ABC News contributor. Colonel Ganyard, we had expected Iran to do something. On a scale of like 1 to 10, how alarming did this attack end up being?
I think when the attack started, Brad, it was a 10 in terms of how alarmed we were. I can't find anybody, either inside or outside of government, who actually anticipated the numbers of missiles and drones and cruise missiles that were actually shot at Israel. Hmm. So that part of it, until we saw how effective the air defenses were and missile defenses were in Israel, was quite alarming. By the end of the night, when we saw how few impacts had any real damage done, it was down to about a 2. Huh. So thanks to technology, started out very, very scary and ended up about as happy as an ending as it could have.
Hey, Iran, I'm just thinking from the Iranian perspective, they had a lot of options, right? Because they could have attacked an Israeli embassy. They could have had one of their proxy groups launch this attack. They chose to do it themselves, and they chose to do it in Israel itself. Why?
I think part of it was that when the Israelis hit the consulate, the so-called consulate in Damascus, which was really just a Quds Force and an IRGC headquarters, they took it as a direct assault on Iranian sovereignty, because most embassies and consulates are thought of as being sovereign land in whatever country that they're located. And so they saw that. They saw another humiliation of another senior IRGC general and a couple of his cronies taken out. It was a huge embarrassment for Iran. And really, at home, it all comes back to domestic politics. The mullahs and those running the regime in Iran could not stand losing face and not doing anything directly. Mm-hmm. What was really surprising was most people thought that they would come in with some sort of a, well, this is just for a show, you know, maybe we'll launch 30 drones at Israel to show that we did something. Nobody expected the kind of attack and the magnitude of the attack that we saw.
Does that mean that Iran was essentially ready for? I'm just thinking, if those missiles had all fallen and they had killed thousands of Israelis, Israel would be at a full-scale war with Iran today. Am I getting that right?
I think so. You know, it's hard to understand their calculus here. But, you know, we have very little insight into how they think or what they're thinking or even what their intent is here. But certainly they must have known that Israel would come back at them. You know, they made all sorts of pronouncements, and they told the U.S. through back channels with a Swiss, hey, we're done, that's it, you know, nothing further to happen here. And it's like, it's not going to work that way. You know, the gloves are finally off. The shadow war between Israel and Iran that's been going on for decades is now out in the open. Mm. It's the best thing for Netanyahu that he could have ever asked for, because now he doesn't have to deal with the Iranian proxies, the Houthis, Hamas, Hezbollah. He can go right at Iran. Mm. So,
like he's been saying for years, like, this is all Iran's doing. And then people are like, okay, fine. Well, now it clearly is.
Right. And they always had the cutouts. They always had the plausible deniabilities. They always, somebody else was dying for their cause using their money and their weapons. But now there's a direct fingerprint. We know who did this. They deliberately attacked Israel, even though they didn't do much military damage. It does give Israel free rein to go after Iranian military activities and installations inside of Iran. And Iran is very, very vulnerable. Israel has a much better capability to project power through air power, through submarine cruise missiles. Iran does not have anything like the air defenses that Israel has, and they will be essentially vulnerable to any kind of attack that Israel decides to undertake.
So Iran put out a statement that basically said, like, okay, we're good, this is over. I'm sure the U.S. would probably love to think that it's over, but is that how Israel sees it? What do you see sort of playing out now with the U.S. and with Israel and the whole thing here?
It is what the White House would like. If Israel goes back in, and we're hearing from the White House, they know they're going to go do something, but they want to make it something proportional, something modest, something that's not going to turn the whole region into a lake of fire. And so the White House wants to have things continue to calm down. They don't want this to turn into a regional conflict. On the other hand, the Israelis see Iran as the source of all their problems. Iran uses the Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas as proxies, and they all attack Israel. And so now Israel has the chance to go back in and take out that part of the Iranian military that they believe is supplying the surrogates who attack Israel on a daily basis. So from a military perspective here, the Israelis see this as a terrific opening to once and for all punch Iran in the nose and hopefully have Iran calm down and not continue to use its proxies in places like Gaza and Syria and Lebanon.
But just to be clear, you see the Israelis now going into Iranian airspace, doing strikes the same way that Iran just did to Israel?
I would give it a 90% chance.
Wow, unbelievable here. All right, Colonel Stephen Gagner, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, next up on Start Here, any other day, this would be the lead story. The criminal trial of a former U.S. president is about to get underway. We'll take you there after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/starthere today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/starthere. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. could be a job all in itself to keep up with the charges against former President Donald Trump. Altogether, Trump faces 4 criminal indictments in 4 different cities, all as election season is now in full swing. Well, today, a historic case gets underway in New York City, because today, finally, is the day Trump becomes the first former U.S. president to stand trial on criminal charges. It's beginning. In this case, he's accused of falsifying business records of hush money payments. Let's bring in ABC's John Santucci, our executive editorial producer covering investigations. John, you've been prepping for this for months now. Can you just sort of tee me up on what this case is and what's about to happen?
I mean, this is the first one, Brad. If you can believe it, it's nearly a year ago that Donald Trump was first indicted on criminal charges. And it's that case, that first indictment, that now is going to trial.
All I can do is tell the truth. And the truth is that there's no case. They have no case.
So, Brad, here's what's interesting. This case is about election interference, but it's not the 2020 election, which most people think about when they hear those words.
Right.
It's actually 2016. This is about Donald Trump and his ally at the time, Michael Cohen's efforts to basically catch and kill. It's a practice we've heard now and become too familiar with. The idea that a damaging story is out there, you pay somebody off to kill it, to make the story go away. And in this case, it's about a payment that was made to adult film star Stormy Daniels.
I relish the day that I get to face him and speak my truth.
Allegedly, she had an affair with Donald Trump, and it's about a payment to catch and kill that story and make it go away.
The participant scheme was illegal.
And reimbursement payments that Trump made to Michael Cohen that he wrote down as legal fees, which is what we're getting into a real issue here, Brad.
The $130,000 wire payment exceeded the federal campaign contribution cap, and the false statements in AMI's books violated New York law.
Prosecutors say this is all about falsifying documents, right? Covering up what the actual payments were for, and thus to impact the election. Now, on the flip side, Trump's team is going to say, look, this was something related to his personal life. Donald Trump didn't want to embarrass himself and his family, didn't want to cause any pain amongst the Trumps. So thus, he basically made the story go away because it would have upset his personal life.
So, like, no one's arguing with the idea that, like, they caught the story and tried to kill the story with money. It's a question of why you did it, whether it's, like, was it to help your election chances? That would be bad. Or just to, like, help your marriage, because that's actually not against the law.
Well, it's all of that, and it's also the idea, because at the end of the day, these are 34 criminal counts about falsifying business records, right? So that's really what we're getting to here.
Got
in
it.
Some ways, right? And the idea that the prosecutors are making is that, look, this is what it was for, he lied, et cetera. And what Trump's team is saying, look, it's a personal matter, had nothing to do with the campaign, nothing to do with the Trump organization, so thus, who cares?
I see. Okay, and we should add, Trump is denied having an affair. He's also said things like the Stormy nonsense happened many years ago, so I guess you can make of that what you will. He also says all of his criminal charges are politically motivated. John, what happens today? Like, before they even make the opening arguments or something, they have to impanel a jury, right?
What's going to happen, Brad, is that hundreds of New Yorkers are going to pile into this small courtroom in downtown Manhattan for jury selection, which is a process all of us have had. We've all gone to jury duty at one point in our lives, or we've avoided it. That's a whole other issue. But if you are a juror that's up for jury duty in Manhattan, you could be on the Trump case. And they've already sent out questionnaires, Brad, asking potential jurors if they're a supporter of Donald Trump's, they're familiar with him, do they subscribe to any conspiracy theories like QAnon? That's going to be something that prosecutors and Trump's legal team are going to ask as they try to whittle this group down.
The most important question is going to be, who is on that jury?
Brad, if you can find 12 people that don't know who Donald Trump is, man, I think we should, you know, I don't know who they are, but God, they're something else, right? But
we should do a better job.
Exactly, right? They're definitely not you, me, and anybody else we work with. But listen, at the end of the day, it's not so much about that, right? It's, do you have a strong opinion on Donald Trump? And we've all met people that have strong opinions on Donald Trump, whether you like him, love him, or hate him, right? That's something that they're going to try to whittle out as people that are a bit more agnostic to who Donald Trump is. Now, that's going to be difficult, certainly, but nevertheless, that's the goal. That eventually, once they have this jury, a jury of 12 plus alternates, they'll be the ones to hear this case. It'll go on for several weeks, Brad, in that Manhattan courtroom.
Hey, regardless of even what the verdict is, what will be the effect of this case, just the ongoing trial, on the election?
What's interesting about that, Brad, is that it affects the election immediately because Donald Trump can't campaign as much.
I don't know how you can have a trial that's going on right in the middle of an election. Not fair. Not fair.
Most courts sit on a 5-day schedule, or a 4-day schedule is more typical. Judges usually take Fridays off. This actually is kind of interesting. The judge here does local service, community service, on Wednesdays. So that's going to be the off day. So Donald Trump's going to be in a courtroom Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. When you talk to his campaign staff, it's endlessly frustrating because usually they'll go off and start doing events later in the week because most people are around later in the week. Huh. Wednesdays are kind of complicated. So one of the things Team Trump has talked about is that they'll do campaign events around the New York area, some of which could be in New York, because they're going to try to find a way to reach their supporters. I don't think they're going to find a way to flip New York red, but you never know. That's something that they have in a dream somewhere. But this is going to make it complicated to actually get out the message, get out mm-hmm. the vote. And as Donald Trump certainly is the presumptive Republican nominee at this rate, Brad, he still has work to do. There's still a lot of fundraising that needs to happen, a lot of hands that need to be shaken, and a lot of things that need to be worked towards the convention, the debates, and really get us into the fall. So when his schedule is so caught up because for several hours during the day he's in a courtroom, it makes the other business just a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, especially when we consider how many, there could be more trials down the road, but for right now, it's this one. This is the first time a former U.S. president stands trial criminally. John Santucci, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, it's tough to keep the streets squeaky clean, but you don't want to welcome everyone to a mouse-warming party. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. Oh, rats. We try to trap them, trick them, and kill them, but could there be a better option? You probably heard that Flocko, the beloved Eurasian owl that escaped the Central Park Zoo, died last month after more than a year of flying free around Manhattan. It was thought he met his demise hitting a window, but further examination revealed a host of health issues, including that Flocko had ingested rat poison.
Flocko didn't have to die! Flocko's laws will let birds fly!
So last week in New York City, a city councilor proposed a new bill. Instead of putting rat poison out on the streets, which is a risk to dogs, cats, and squirrels who prowl the sidewalks, along then with the birds of prey that chase them, what if we gave the rats birth control? This is a real idea, and actually not a novel one. For years, sanitation departments have experimented with contraceptives that would prevent female rats from giving birth. You just stick them in some bait and let the rats eat them up. The idea is that this would be a more effective long-term plan than killing them. After all, a single pair of rats can theoretically produce 15,000 offspring in the course of a year. But it would also relieve the sanitation workers of what's become a pretty uncomfortable question of animal cruelty. Zoologists say death by poison is extremely painful for rats and mice. Even worse are glue traps, which have now been banned in several American cities. There's a federal bill floating around Congress that would ban them nationwide. Some exterminators prefer carbon monoxide, the gas which can lull animals to sleep, but that's tough to pull off on the scale of a whole housing community or subway stop. And that's really the issue here. We got lots of methods in this country for battling rats, but the rats keep winning, even against this birth control plan that's been tried before. So why would it work this time? Well, New York Mayor Eric Adams has made trash a cornerstone of his first term in office. He's commanded local businesses to place their trash in big containers rather than just in bags they toss on the street. He's fining homeowners who put their trash out too early. He's even created a city government position known as just the Rat Czar.
I will bring a science and systems-based approach to reducing New York City's rat population.
And it's starting to work. Rat sightings are down significantly. The hope is now that rats have fewer opportunities to scavenge food, they'll snap up this bait even more readily. One researcher said these salty treats taste even better than pizza, which means you also got to make sure this contraception only works on rats, because every creature from New York likes the taste of pizza. My apartment had a mouse in it earlier this year, and our solution ended up being not to kill it, but just wait until it went inside a hole in the wall, seal all the gaps and cracks in our house, and then when our neighbors started freaking out about mouse sightings, that's when we knew we had succeeded. Very inhumane to our neighbors, but otherwise, I felt like we had all of our bases covered. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.